Welcome to Women in Politics, recorded here in the studios of WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio. I'm Carol Olson, your host for Women in Politics. It's a platform to bring women together to talk about their engagement in politics, what's important to them, and what they want our representatives and delegates to hear. Welcome to Women in Politics. My guest today is Alyssa Baldwin, Republican candidate for Senate in Virginia. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Carol. I appreciate the opportunity. So this is a statewide election for everyone in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I have jumped into the deep end of the political pool, coming from not being a political appointee already or elected official. This is my first run for elected office. And so it's been something new to learn every day, but very exciting to get out there and meet everybody in Virginia.
What got you involved in politics?
So I have long been involved in politics. I grew up in a family that really valued history and service above self, and had two grandfathers that served in the Army and, you know, took me on the tours of all the historical monuments. And then we had conversations about, you know, the fact that freedom isn't free and people fought, bled, and died for this country. And of course, that then prompted government conversations and how we came to, you know, have this great constitutional republic that we do. And so I started, you know, being the cute kid in campaign literature and then going with my dad to the polling places and handing out that literature and knocking doors. And of course, the older I got and the more I learned, I was able to understand, you know, my own political ideology and defend that in a public space with conversations with other people, and served in leadership roles while I was at college with the College of Republicans at University of Richmond, and then helped on some campaigns, generally behind the scenes, because that's the way I preferred it. So again, this is the first time putting myself out there as a candidate, but I really feel like the people of Virginia deserve better than our current senator. And who better than a civics teacher who knows the Constitution and what government should look like to go to DC and represent the people of Virginia.
As a member of the Republican Party, you're really a minority as a politician or someone stepping into as a woman stepping to the political sphere.
Yes.
Tell me what it's like to be a woman in the Republican Party that is heavily male dominated and has not necessarily been historically as welcoming toward women.
And so that is true and not true all at the same time. So if you look at history, I'm a history teacher by trade. The Republican Party has long been the party that advances civil liberties for individuals, including women. So most of the activists, you know, even with women's suffrage, were actually members of the Republican Party in their home states and helping to secure the right to vote for all women nationwide, which of course is so important or I wouldn't be here now. And so I am one of 18 Republican women, though, seeking the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate. And so that still suggests that women are underrepresented in elected office when it comes to conservative politics in particular. And unfortunately, the Democrats have done a better job of recruiting women because of different political committees that they've got out there besides their party, which benefits their candidates in election cycles. And so, I'm a strong conservative woman, and there are others just like me out there on the battleground. We just need to do a better job of connecting with all voters, because really women's issues are people issues. And I think that women candidates can do a better job of relating to people. Our soft skills are stronger. You know, we're better listeners, we're better communicators. And I think that's very valuable when you're looking to have someone serve and represent and be your voice in office.
How do you think that your presence in politics is going to be able to encourage more women to get engaged of any political party? How do you see yourself being part of that leadership and mentorship?
Yes. So it's a banner and a label that I'm taking very seriously and being mindful of, that, you know, I'm not just representing myself as a brand for candidacy, but also a party and, you know, my gender and all too. So I am a teacher. I'm used to inspiring the next generation to go out and live their best life, to dream big. Ronald Reagan actually said, America's too great to dream small dreams. And I love that. And so I think that anything men can do, women can do, and a woman's place is absolutely in the House, the Senate, and the Oval Office. And it doesn't have to be about gender politics. It's about policies. And I think that women can do a better job of legislating in a lot of ways.
You talked about feeling that the Republican Party is for women. So how are you going to vote, or what are your opinions on the amendment for women?
So are you referencing the Equal Rights Amendment? Okay, so I think personally that it's a misnomer. I've actually lobbied against it at the state and federal level because if you drill down past that introductory paragraph, which sounds good, I mean, we all want equality, but if you drill down past that first paragraph into, you know, Article 2, Section 2, it's really about abortion as a fundamental right, and I don't support that effort. And right now, women are already equal thanks to the 14th Amendment and the 5th Amendment with due process. So I don't think that we need another constitutional amendment, especially one that is so inaccurately named if you read the longer narrative of it, of the bill.
I myself did not think that abortion was a part of the Equal Rights Amendment. But
it's
really
a big
just
part.
About women making sure they have equal status that is protected under law.
Well, and if you read the legislation, the word woman is actually not used. And so that concerns me as well, because there are different biological differences between men and women. And so we have to be mindful of that. Otherwise, we're science deniers.
Okay. How do you see yourself working across party and working with Democrats who think so differently than you, or any other political parties that are not as active or as big, like the Green Party or Independents? How do you see yourself reaching those voters and working with those representatives of those parties?
I'm really glad that you asked that question, Carol, because as a teacher, my preparation has been about bringing people together with different perspectives, different roles, and solving hard problems together. And I'm someone who believes that it absolutely is beneficial to put more minds together to tackle those problems and brainstorm solutions and really attack the situation to make it better for everyone. And I've been quite successful in doing that in the classroom, in the community as a citizen leader, and look forward to doing that in Washington, D.C. as well, to really bring stakeholders together. Because at the end of the day, if we're using the Constitution as our framework, which we should be doing more of, you know, I'm someone who thinks it needs to be reread, not rewritten, then that does give us the common ground that we need to legislate and find those innovative solutions together. Some of my lunchtime conversations are with people who have very different political views, and yet when we flesh out the core issues, we're really able to come up with some creative solutions together and put aside those party labels and get the job done. And I think that's something I can bring to the table and bring to DC and the Senate.
Speaking of your interest in the Constitution and looking at the current administration and under Trump and some of the accusations that he may not understand the Constitution or he's trying to circumvent it, how do you feel about the current leadership in the White House and their interpretations of the Constitution?
So I think that if, you know, the question could be going in several different directions. So let me know if I'm taking it in the wrong direction from your intention. But I think the Trump administration has done overall a great job of putting America first and the American workers first and looking out for our own national interest. Certainly during the coronavirus response, we've heard comments like, you know, if the states won't shut down, then we're going to come in. If the states won't open up, we're going to come in. And of course, we know that with the 10th Amendment, if a power is not specifically given to the federal government, it is reserved to the states and to the people of those states, respectively. And so that, you know, sometimes can just be political talk and political theater. But I think at the end of the day, the intention is to benefit America and the American people, which I fully support.
Do you think, or are you implying that when Trump makes those statements, that he's engaging what can sound like threats to the governors, that it's political theater?
I think all politics is theater at the national level right now. And everybody is trying to, you know, vie for their own opportunity to shine in the spotlight. Sometimes that's not necessarily the most beneficial thing in terms of a course of action. But I think that when those comments are made, that the intention is always to put America first and make sure that we are coming together to be solving the problem and balancing, you know, with the coronavirus in particular, public safety, but also the public economics that we've got.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Women in Politics, producing the studios of WRIRLP 97.3 FM, Richmond's independent radio. I'm your host, Carol Olson, and today I'm talking with Alyssa Baldwin, candidate for United States Senate. And let's talk about COVID. it's likely or it's projected that COVID will make a resurgence, or the coronavirus will make a resurgence in the fall. Should you win the seat, how will you engage in leading Virginia through what could be the second phase of a pandemic?
I think that the reality is we will see a second wave, because the solution that we adopted was always about stemming the tide and making sure that we did not overwhelm our healthcare system. And so with any, you know, global outbreak like what we've seen, luckily it's been less severe nationwide than what we had anticipated, and that's a blessing for us. But I think when we, you know, open things back up and we go back to experiencing life again, then there is going to be another surge, another wave. And so we have to be mindful of basic hygiene and things that we should always do as general precautions. I worked and volunteered nearly a decade as an EMT in the pre-hospital setting. And so I know, you know, the hand washing and sanitation are just basic measures that people sometimes don't take too seriously, and they need to for their own health and for that of others. If I'm fortunate enough to win in the primary and then again in November, I would be in the seat when we're looking at legislative policy and funding to support any healthcare needs. And I think now that we've softened and flattened the curve, that we will be better equipped with our hospitals and our protective equipment and ventilators and things like that, and won't need to see as much of that emergency funding like we saw experienced this past spring.
So in terms of distribution of PPE and ventilators, do you feel like it's the government's responsibility to have provided that to the states, because there has been controversy surrounding them actually taking some of the supplies from states and then reselling it through yet a third party, and some sharing with other countries when there might be a need and shortages in our own. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think sometimes we saw that the conversation was about shortages, and then the personal protective equipment and the supplies that were needed were found in warehouse storage. You know, I think of New York as a current example of that situation. And so sometimes it's not about having it, it's about having access to it. And unfortunately, a lot of those supplies were, you know, redistributed and not refilled when they were used under the Obama administration. And so to lay the blame fully on the Trump administration, I think, is unfair. And now that we've gotten ahead of the curve and ahead of the situation, I think they're doing a remarkable job nationwide to get the equipment and the supplies where they're needed the most. And many of the field hospitals have now been able to close down, and nurses have been reassigned back to their home hospitals and things like that. And I think that's important. A lot of it really does come down to public and private partnerships, because many of the hospitals are not government owned, of course, they are private entities. But to have that support of the federal government when you're facing a national health crisis is valid.
Do you want to talk about your campaign stance?
I'd love to. So the theme that I've got for the campaign is Only in America, which was inspired by the Brooks and Dunn song about someone from a rural part of the community growing up to dream patriotic dreams. And that really just describes who I am, being from the rural part of Virginia and, you know, wanting to do public service for God and for country, and to really live my teaching. My three favorite words in the Constitution, my eighth graders would tell you, are "we the people." And I say that over and over, you know, who's got the power? We the people, until they understand that really people are the fourth unofficial branch of government. And for too long, people have sat back because politics can get nasty and ugly, and nobody wants to be involved. And yet, if we don't get involved as voters and as candidates and as public servants, then the process falls apart of representative democracy like we have. So it's been a joy to balance my civics teaching with that kind of remediation of adults on the campaign trail, because a lot of things that you learn about government when you're young, unless you are very active in the political scene, you tend to forget, and you just show up once a year to cast your ballot.
Right.
And so people have found that refreshing, and they're not afraid to answer questions because they know that I'm willing to walk them through the process of, you know, everything from getting registered to vote to, you know, primary participation versus general election. Because there are differences. And even when I was first announcing my candidacy I had folks go, well, I can't vote for you. I'm voting for Senator so-and-so. And I had to explain, well, that's a different level of government. That's state government. This is federal government. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to your Civics 101 lessons. So, but people really have found the message that I'm bringing inspiring and hopeful because, you know, I describe myself as an optimistic pragmatist. You know, I'm a realist at the end of the day, but I do bring that sense of optimism and hope for a better future because I've seen working in the classroom that when you bring people together around that common goal, anything is possible. And if you believe it, you can achieve it. And so people have been very receptive to that message about at the grassroots level, just getting involved and having those conversations and taking back our commonwealth.
It's so interesting to talk about civics and education because I do think many people, you know, you're right, they don't fully understand the political process or what our representatives and legislators do. Part of the reason for me starting this show was actually to give voice to that, particularly to not just to women candidates, but to women voters, but also just to highlight that to have a show that talks about the political process. And I see education is one of your platforms, helping adult education. What do you think about college for free? What do you think about having college far more accessible to everybody, every community member, instead of those just with, you know, college costs are rising and we're starting to price people out of even attending.
I'm a first generation college student. And so I know full well that costs are astronomical and will continue to rise. So I fully support like state caps of the state funded in public institutions for higher education, but really that college is not for everyone. And for too long, that's been the narrative that we've sold everybody. And the average college graduate leaves with over $25,000 of debt. And, you know, I had more than that because I chose to go to a private university for my experience, which was invaluable. It was invaluable, but it did cost. Mm-hmm. It was not truly invaluable. And so, you know, when you make those choices, no one was walking me through that decision. Again, I was the first generation college student. So it was just kind of a stab in the dark and hope for the best. And so I think we have to make sure that our young people know that college is not the only pathway to a future of success. My plumber, my mechanic make far more than I do as a teacher. And I incurred a lot more student loan debt than they ever would or did. And so having an education reform system where the power is back in the hands of the parents and the local and state governments, I think can bring with it that funding as well and give the states more control over the cost of higher education in addition. But it should not be free because there is a price tag, but universities should do a better job of trimming the fat in their bureaucracy levels with, you know, some random administrative hires and make sure that the money is invested on, you know, in K-12 education with infrastructure and making sure that every student has that best education. Because I do see the disparity even within the same school division from one end of the county to the other. And that's unfair to those students who just because they're in a different neighborhood are having what would be an inequitable education. But college does have a cost and we need to do a better job of educating students about their options and being realistic with the cost that, you know, if you sign the dotted line for that loan, then you're responsible for making those payments and understand the burden and kind of the return on investment.
So education reform can also include the perception of equity and classism in our society. So people with college degrees are viewed as having higher status. And so it sounds like what you're proposing is that should be overhauled as well. Instead, if we're looking at trade schools, separating out trade schools from colleges, however, they're both educational institutions, and having that sense of whether you're a plumber or you're a college professor, you should access equal status in our communities. Is that something you're promoting then in your education reform?
Absolutely, because we all have a role to play in society. And I think we have to find our passion and our strengths. And when those come together, you know, we truly can make a difference in our corner of the world and best meet our own needs for our family as well. And so I think that giving people the flexibility and the freedom to choose without being judged as less than is very important and should be supported with innovation and an increase in those opportunities.
How do you see yourself leading that? Because since the Republican Party, since you mentioned the past of the Republican Party, but since it's become the party of the conservatives, they haven't always had that voice, especially recently or in the last few decades, that voice of dealing with social inequity and dealing with keeping those who have been traditionally marginalized through income levels, job access, through educational access. How do you see yourself leading that as a Republican to balance out the inequities in our society and address having opportunities and access for people who are marginalized, and people, meaning that people who are people of color or people who are poor, sometimes they're the same and sometimes they're different, women, sexual minorities, religious minorities.
So I think it's important to understand that at its core, to be a Republican and to be a conservative, it's about less government. And, you know, so often everybody wants to find a legislative solution to the problem. And sometimes it's really advocacy or deregulation that is the solution to the problem, and opening up, you know, free enterprise and competition and that sort of thing. So I think I can certainly be an advocate for that reform effort and leading the way that we're all people and it should not matter the pigmentation of our skin or, you know, our gender or anything like that, that we all have the opportunity to live the American dream. But it's the difference, I think, between Republicans and Democrats on that is that I feel strongly it's not the government's place to make it so. You know,
true.
We can't legislate that solution.
It's our place, right? Us as individuals.
Correct.
You and me.
As individuals,
right.
As we the people, you know, boots on the ground, that we're looking out for each other and making sure to encourage and support and find those pathways forward.
So really what I'm saying is that being in politics gives you a voice. You know, you're someone,
yes.
Everybody in your community is going to look toward these answers. And some of the things you're going to be asked for to lead on aren't just bills that pass through, but are how do you respond to everybody that you represent? And how do you use your voice and the platform that comes with being a delegate or a legislator or a senator out in the community? And it's a unique opportunity to lead and hold up the hands of everybody in your community, right? Even if they don't,
right.
Even if they didn't vote for you.
That's right. And so when you're serving an elected office, you really are being the voice. But in order to be their voice, you have to be a good listener. And for too long, politicians have done their own thing and been listening and bending their will and their votes even towards special interest groups and lobbyists and not the people and the constituents that they represent back in their home states or their home districts. And so I think by listening and being in tune with the conversations that people are having at the dinner table and, you know, shopping malls and retail establishments, that I can then give, you know, some microphone time, some voice to those issues from a legislative perspective. And that's an important difference between me and the other two candidates that are even seeking the nomination. You know, their preparation and skill set is different than mine in that regard. So leadership, my style of leadership is really that of servant or transformational leadership. And it requires listening and partnering with individuals to then find an avenue together. And yes, some of that will be legislated, but I think a lot of our social construct issues come from too much legislation and trying to find a bill to become a law on Capitol Hill that is either too broad or too filled with pet projects that it becomes unmanageable when it's really implemented. And that's a hardship on us as citizens.
Yeah, I think you can get people on the other political parties to agree with you on too much pork and law.
Yes, single issue bills would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to try to get career politicians to agree to that is probably an uphill battle. But so is campaigning in a purple state when you're a conservative woman and don't have the political, you know, network mm-hmm. that establishment candidates do. So I've never looked at that as a limitation or let someone else define my own limits. If they count me out, they've counted wrong.
Okay. We have time for one more question real quick.
Okay.
Voting.
Great, Carol.
So there's the push to have mail-in votes, especially because of COVID. And then there are people who have wanted that all along. Of course, there are groups that have been doing mail-in voting all along anyway. How do you feel about mail-in voting in Virginia?
That mail-in voting can lead to a lot of fraud. And I'm concerned about that because everyone's vote matters and everyone should have their vote heard. And it's too easy, I think, for mail-in voting to be disrupted and rob someone of their voice in the election process. And so we have to do everything to make sure that our elections are secure and to have it open for any reason, any person at all times, does concern me. I know that my own mailbox was vandalized here recently, and luckily I was able to get most things back, I think, based on the usual metric of what I receive in the mailbox. But, you know, if that had been a ballot that had been taken from my mailbox and then someone filled it out with my name on it and submitted it, then that's stealing my opportunity to participate in the election cycle. And then to have ballots turned in without witnesses and things like that, I think we're asking problems than helping in that situation.
That begs the question. We have the military gets to do mail-in voting, and there's never been accusations of fraud through the military. And then other groups like Congress gets to do, the president gets to do mail-in voting, and there haven't been accusations of fraud, in fact, or findings of fraud. In fact, despite the fact that we have such concern about fraud, there's really been hardly any fraud that's ever actually been proven to have happened. So why couldn't citizens have the same access to or reduce the barriers to voting that the military has? I mean we're talking, and I don't see it as a party issue at all. It has become one for some reason, but really mail-in voting benefits any party because you have people who would struggle to get to the polls, people whose work doesn't allow them. There are many private businesses that don't follow national holidays and people still have to work and can't get to the poll. So this would allow everyone to have the same benefit military has. And we haven't had any problems with fraud through the military. So why would we now?
I think that it's a system of a question of scale, you know, to have our military be able to fill out those ballots or the average citizen for limited reasons, you know, a medical condition or an employment situation makes sense. But if you multiply that and have the large scale of every citizen doing that same thing, again, just because I've seen mailboxes vandalized and I've read articles about buckets of ballots that were cast and then found after the election, I do have
from in-person voting, right? From in-person voting, right?
But also with absentee ballots that were, you know, claimed to be mailed and then not received and not processed. So I do have, I just have concerns about that from the systemic and the matter of scale, and would certainly like to see more precautions taken before we move in that direction. Because right now, even with absentee, there's so many weeks before the election that you can go and vote at the registrar's office or other locations set up by the county registrar to cast a absentee ballot in person. And so to say that there's, you know, that one election day and people can't participate, there are actually lots more opportunities now than there were when I was a kid.
Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Carol. I really appreciate the opportunity to share with you and your listeners.
You've been listening to Women in Politics, recorded here in the studios of WRIR-LP 97.3 FM. To hear this show, please go to our blog at womenpoliticsva.blog. To support independent radio, to learn, volunteer, or donate, please go to WRIR.org.